Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Here we are! Right, brilliant. Can you hear me? You can hear me.
I can hear you.
Right. Okay. I'm turning up my microphone because my headphones are quiet. But yes. My name is Nick,
and this my name is Nathaniel Metcalf.
And you're listening to Nick
and Nathaniel Metcalf's
Five Star Family Fun Size Fan Club. So there you go. First rule of fan club is
tell your friends. Tell your friends about fan club.
Tell your friends about fan club. Second rule of fan club is
please, for the love of God, tell your friends about fan club.
Do tell your friends about fan club. Yes. So at the moment, we're still in lockdown. For people that are listening in the future, and for people that are listening now, we're still in lockdown. We're making the best out of it. So we're broadcasting live from Camp COVID. Today, we are broadcasting on a Wednesday, aren't we?
It's Wednesday, the 29th of April.
We're not broadcasting, are we? We're not broadcasting on a Wednesday. We're recording it on a Wednesday for the Friday. So, you know, you can tweet us if you like, but we won't get it till next week. but today's a very special day, isn't it? Because it's the halfway between Christmas and New Year.
No, it isn't. That's not for a little while. There's a more
it's
important...
Not, it's a much more important thing. So today is Nathaniel's birthday.
Ah!
So I've got you an entire Oreo cookie with your favourite colour, green candle in it.
There you go. For the benefit of the listeners, Nick has presented me an Oreo cookie. He hasn't even presented it to me. He's showing me it via his camera, an Oreo cookie with a green candle stuck through it. It's lit, though, a lit candle. Thank you very much, Nick.
So through the magic of the internet, right, what we'll do is I'll sing happy birthday to you, and then at the end of that, you blow your candle out, and we'll see if the magic of the internet...
Okay, I'll try and blow the candle out through the screen.
Yeah. Sure. Okay, so happy birthday to you. Everyone join in. Happy birthday
to you.
Happy birthday, dear Nat. Happy birthday to you.
Okay.
3, 2, 1, blow the candle out. Oh, my God.
It worked.
That's incredible.
Hello.
Wow. I wonder if other things have the internet work as well.
Maybe. Well, let's hope I don't have the virus, Nick, because I'll definitely have passed it on there.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not worried about the virus. In terms of happy birthday, anyway.
Thank you for eating my Oreo.
Oh, God, this is a real fucking fuck show.
You're eating Oreos while we're on air. I especially had a banana before we went on.
Yeah, but this is your birthday Oreo, isn't it? So, I'm celebrating
the Oreos.
You. That's your problem at this point. These are mint Oreos. It's not as bad as that time I ate a whole packet of bacon on air.
You know what? Now I think back on it, it does seem unprofessional. At the time, it felt a bit... It's fine, isn't it?
It was John Robbins,
it's a relaxed show.
John Robbins.
You should point out that the bacon was cooked.
Oh, yeah, it was cooked bacon.
It was cooked bacon, yeah. To be fair. It wasn't raw bacon.
No, but John Robbins was absolutely disgusted.
You know what? Thinking back, he was probably right.
No! He just doesn't appreciate my charm.
No. He might also be vegan, is he, John?
No. Okay. Well, he might be. He didn't say he was at the time. But also, just because you're vegan doesn't mean you're automatically disgusted with other people that eat. You know, and what time... It's not my fault that this is scheduled over lunchtime. Yeah. Normally, you know, between 12 and 2. Today, it's between...
Well, we could actually have this at any time.
We could have this at any time. We've got an extra special guest today.
We do. Excited about it.
Which we're very excited about. And my voice is a bit crap because I'm recording a thing at the moment, some music at the moment, and I was up all night singing into my microphone, and but I had to stop. I've got a curfew of about midnight because of my neighbours, and I'm a bit worried about them, but it's fine. Anyway, cool. And we're off. So, what have you been a fan of this week, Nathaniel? Hang on. Are you having a nice birthday?
It's been all right so far, yeah. It's been all right. It feels very, like, lots has happened. It feels like, well, not a lot's happened. I haven't done anything.
Sorry, I've just got to stop you there. News just in, John Robbins is vegan.
Okay, good to know.
Where were we? Oh, yeah, you were telling me about your birthday. Go on.
I feel like I haven't got a lot done. And I always feel like this starts, recording. By the time this starts, I feel like my day hasn't begun yet. And I'm sort of rushing to get things done. I've eaten a banana. I've got a cup of coffee. It's all going to be all right. And it feels rushed.
The days go by really quickly. I've been up since 9 and it's already 2 o'clock. And I've tried to get as much done as I
can't believe it. I find like everyone talks about how bored they are. It just feels like by the time I've woken up, I'm already going back to bed. It just feels like I can't seem to get much done in a day.
The distance between 5 o'clock in the afternoon and midnight is just fucking nuts. It just sort of just flies by. I've just never got enough time to do anything. And I think, oh, yeah, I can do that in a day. And I can't. I can get about, you know, I think you were like saying the other day, you can get about one or two things done and you go, that's my day. Like, you put your washing on, and then, I mean, I'm talking about your experience, because what I do is I put my washing on, and then I just leave it until it starts getting mould, and then I have to wash it again, which is, you know, but thankfully I don't own a lot of clothes, so it's not that bad for the environment, I suppose, but, I mean, you got to have clean clothes. Anyway. Oh, it's not a vintage one, is it? So, it's just, I mean, there's no exterior information, stimulation.
Yeah, I'm trying to have each day have a structure. So I do try and have things going on. I try and ring my mum about 10 in the morning. That's my sort of aim. I have breakfast. I do try and watch The Chase at 5 p.m. These are the big sort of big lampposts of the day that I have to try and get between. But, I mean, by the time The Chase starts, I might have done absolutely nothing.
Fucking hell. I mean, fucking hell. No, that's all right. That's all right. But like, one of my mates had a birthday the other day, and I just said, you know, we'll put a pin in it, and we'll sort of celebrate when it's over. Is that sort of thing that you think, or are you know, just sort of like writing this one off and just pretending it never happened?
Yeah, it's fine as well. It's fine. It's like
are you into birthdays. Are you into birthdays?
Not especially, and. But, you know, it's fine and it's nice. It's nice to be here. Nice to have a chat to people. I'm getting lots of nice texts. But this is quite nice. I get to have a chat. This is a bit of a treat on my birthday.
I was watching an online thing. I didn't know it was your birthday today until Facebook told me. And I was watching this online thing about 5 months ago. And I found a book that they were talking about, and I've had it in my basket for about 5 months. So I'm gonna send it to you via Amazon. But so I had it. I was just like, Nat would like that. And then it's not even like I hadn't even thought about it, but I thought I was 5 months early. But there you go. I used to have a girlfriend like that. I'd get home and she said, I'd film for like 15 hours and I'd get home and she said, I was thinking about cooking you dinner. And I was like, oh yeah. And she goes, yeah, but I didn't get around to it. And you go, that's fine. It's the thought that counts.
Let's go. It's the thought that counts, though, isn't it? It's the thought that counts.
It is the thought. It is the thought that counts. So, you know, but it's all right. I didn't mind buying dinner. It was fine. It was fine. You know, we went to a nice place. It's all right. It did happen more than once, though. Anyway, so what have you been a fan of this week?
Well, I've started. I watched Greetings, which is a very, very early Brian De Palma film. You've seen that with Robert De Niro.
Robert De Niro. I haven't seen it. He made a few with Robert De Niro, didn't he?
He did.
There's like an early Brian De Palma, Robert De Niro box set that's going around.
That's what
it's
I got.
Going around. People aren't passing it around, but like, I haven't seen it. But that's another one that's been in my basket for a while. But yeah, it's not in my basket. You put stuff in your basket and then you go save for later. It's in my save for later. That's what it is. That's what it is. Is it good?
I really like Greetings. I can see why. It's like a sort of Richard Lester film, like A Hard Day's Night or something. So you really? Go, okay, it's like this. And then by the end of it, I really, really liked it. And there's two others in that box set. There's Hi Mom, which is a sequel to Greetings, which I didn't realise was it's like a direct sequel. Robert De Niro plays the same character in both.
Right.
And I'd say Hi Mom isn't as good. Greetings is like a sort of 60s sort of satire, all people sort of dodging the draft. But it's got like, it's like a comedy. It's like, it's not the kind of film you'd sort of imagine that Brian De Palma would do. But it does have all the stuff in it that's like, that he would go on to do. So like Robert De Niro's character in it is like, he's like a sort of peeping Tom. He's obsessed with kind of voyeurism. And you go, oh, it's weird that it is just like, but like even in this sort of really low budget movie, it's still got these little traits in it that are repeated in his later films, you know. And one of the other characters is obsessed with the Kennedy assassination, and it has a bit where he's talking to the pop art artist, Richard Hamilton, and it's all about taking photos and blowing up certain parts of the photo. And he sort of references going, oh, it's a bit like in the film Blow Up. And it's like, yeah, it's like Blow Up. And they start talking about all this. So it's got these weird, like, echoes of future films that he's about to do but hasn't done yet.
Yeah, right, okay. And is it wacky like A Hard Day's Night?
Kind of. It's got lots of sort of odd bits that are a bit sort of sped up and then sort of jumping and things. And it's like, you know, it's like very much like A Hard Day's Night. Or The Monkeys, I guess, is a good reference point for it.
Wow, that is weird. Wow. And how many films are in this box set?
Three. Greetings is by far the best one, I'd say. Hi Mom has got some really good... They're like... I mean, in a way, they're almost like sort of sketch films, you know? They've got like little 5 or 10 minute scenes that are like sort of sketches put together to have like a sort of story put on them. So it's like lots of vignettes with these characters in various sort of funny scenarios.
Right.
And... but they're essentially like sort of 5-10 minute sketches that are all put together. But I think the hit rate is a lot better in Greetings, but there is a particularly good one in Hi Mom. And the middle one's one called The Wedding Party, which was made before Greetings, but it's, I'd say, just not as good. It's just like, it's a bit of a wacky comedy about like a guy who's marrying into this sort of society family, but it's just not, it's a bit obvious and a bit like, it's like it feels like a really early film, you know. It doesn't feel particularly interesting or like a student film.
But then, so Robert De Niro really didn't do many sequels until later on. Is that right?
He did. Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah,
he didn't do anything. He didn't. He didn't do a sequel until Meet the Fockers. Really, is that right? But
might be.
Except for The Godfather 2, which was he was in, but it wasn't a sequel to one of his own films.
But like, it's weird that you go, when you realise, I mean, I knew these films are out there, like Greetings and Hi Mom, but I didn't realise they were like direct sequels.
Right, yeah. Well, it's weird. It's just weird. It's a weird thing about it. But then I watched Bonfire of the Vanities the other week.
Oh, yeah.
That's Brian De Palma. And I've got his book. I can't remember what it's called. The Devil's Candy, The Making of the Bonfire of the Vanities. And so I'm going to, when I find some time in my busy schedule, I just, do you know what I actually just want to do? Is I just want to sit down and read a fucking book.
I'm like, but, that. When people are just like so bored, I just find myself going, I mean, I just never feel like I've got time in a day. And some days, like when I've got a lot on, like the night before, I'm a bit stressed by how much I've got to do. And I haven't got to do that much, but I just know in comparison, I can just stretch. Once I've learned how to stretch a tiny amount of workout all day, like I did in the early days of the lockdown, now it feels almost impossible to get out of that rhythm.
Sure. But I find that I've always got something that's, I should be doing that's sort of tormenting me in the back of my head. And unless I literally just say, fuck it, I'm not doing anything today, which rarely happens. Normally what happens is I can get nothing done, but I always know that I've got to do something. You know, so it's difficult to. So it's not like. I didn't do the work because I was busy. You know, I don't even watch films. Do you know what I mean? It's just like I don't feel like I'm allowed to watch films because I've got this work to do, and then you end up getting nothing done. Whereas if you actually just say I'm not doing any work today, then you can actually allow yourself to do stuff. But I was watching because Brian Dennehy died. And I was watching a thing, and Brian Dennehy made loads of amazing films. I'm just trying to think of one. But I'm trying to think of the ones that I would have watched when I was growing up. I just remember that they used to show FX and FX2 on sort of like rotation on like ITV when we were growing up. And I always just thought about the FX movies where they would do these FX sequences, special effects sequences. And I think they opened the films with these special effects sequences. And you were meant to believe that kind of like, oh, it's a real thing. It's a real movie that you're watching. This is the movie. And then it cuts and it's just like, oh no, it's just a special effects sequence. And you go, yeah, but that's not how they film special effects sequences. Do you know what I mean? They don't build robot clowns to, which is clearly a person in a costume, in a clown costume that's doing sort of like mime and stuff. They go, no, it's like he's a special effects artist. But what is he? Is he a makeup effects artist? Or is he a pyrotechnics artist? When he hasn't got kind of like, they've given him kind of like a real basic, broad kind of knowledge of every single form of special effects. You couldn't make that film now because it would just be a man, you know, programming stuff into a computer over 5 months. And then, you know, it wouldn't work. But I always remember the FX movies. And Tommy Boy is, I've come to the conclusion that Tommy Boy is probably my favourite film. Where I've been fighting it off for a long time. It's either The Thing or Tommy Boy, but for a very long time, it was Army of Darkness or Royal Tenenbaums. And to be honest, I'm sick to fucking death of Army of Darkness. I've seen it so many times. And the Royal Tenenbaums, I don't watch often enough for it to count as a favourite film. Although I'd say it was in my top 10 or 20, but I couldn't say it was my favourite. Whereas something like Tommy Boy, someone says, oh, what sort of films? I'd always try and do like the intellectual thing, but actually, bottom line is, what should we watch tonight? And I always go, have you seen Tommy Boy? And then they'll be like, no, because no one in England has seen Tommy Boy, really. And then you say,
no, I haven't seen it till you showed me it.
And then have you seen Tommy Boy? They say no. And then you go, all right, okay, and you watch that. It's, yeah.
So you mean you can watch it again and again and again without getting bored, or?
Yeah, and I think it's quotable, and I think it's got one of the all-time best comedy performances in it. You know, Chris Farley's incredible in that. He makes you cry, you know, and he's funny. Not that making you cry is like a... But, you know, the range is that he's doing, like, slapstick, and he's being self-deprecating, and he's really physical, and then all of a sudden he'll sort of like make you cry, and then I think David Spade's incredible. I just think it's really great. Brian Dennehy, he's got like this all-time, he's like one of his all-time best parts, and he's only in it for like the first, I don't know, 20 minutes. And there's this line that he does where... he's sort of introducing Bo Derek to Tommy. It's on Brian Dennehy's wedding day, and he's introducing his new wife, Tommy Boy's new mum. and he's trying to sort of like explain why he's moving on and sort of like getting married again. And Brian Dennehy says, oh, it's something about getting old, you know? And then Chris Farley goes, that's all right, Dad. And the story is that they'd filmed the scene, and then Brian Dennehy says, I've got an idea. Do you mind if I try an idea? And they were like, no, that's okay, fine. Try an idea. And then he gets up, and then and all of the stories on the behind the scenes things were him going, and he just came out with this speech. It was incredible. And you go, wow, I've got to rewatch that scene and see what the speech is. And it's literally Brian Dennehy turning around to Chris Farley going, it's something about getting old. And then that's the speech, and it's just like, you could just be describing what you had planned, do you know what I mean? It was like but it's in the film, and it's sort of like, it's minimalist, but it's really great. And yeah, it's a really great moment, and Brian Dennehy is really good, and he's sort of like, you just think that he's probably because he's an actor, do you know what I mean? And he's in this Saturday Night Live thing where they get covered in shit and push cows over and stuff. And you just think probably Brian Dennehy might be, you know, a little bit too good for this film. Yeah. But he just completely just embraces it and goes with it.
See, I always think that about, like, when you get, like, proper big actors or good actors in those kind of films, it's like all they're really doing is letting themselves down, you know, if they don't actually turn up for work. Because all it is, it just makes you go, actually, they're not that good. Whereas if any of these guys turn up to any film and do a proper performance, it really shows, and it makes you go, yeah, they're great in that. It's like, I think that's it. You've always got to turn up for work and do your job. Otherwise, you will look like an idiot. No one else will, you know.
Yeah.
It's the best way to do it. You've got to do it. You've got to play it straight. It's like what they always said. I mean, going back, and we always talk about the same things, but going back to, like, you know, Peter Cushing or something in a Hammer film, part of the thing is that you believe it because he's reacting like it's all real, you know? It's like you could go, oh, it's a bit silly, some of this stuff. But because he's reacting to it like this is life or death, you totally buy into the whole world of it because he's such a kind of a good actor that he doesn't ever treat it like he's in something that's beneath him.
Yeah, but that was very much, you know, his kind of... That was very much his sort of... his genre, wasn't it? But it's like when they did Star Wars and nobody knew who George Lucas was, nobody could understand the script, but just by having Peter Cushing and Alec Guinness in it, it gave it some weight.
Yeah.
And I probably think that Peter Cushing went along with it a lot more than Alec Guinness.
Yeah.
Considering that they didn't have any scenes together, and Alec Guinness did most of his stuff in Tunisia, and where did they film it? Was it Pinewood or Shepperton?
I think it was Pinewood, isn't it?
So Peter Cushing would have done most of his stuff in England on a studio, and Alec Guinness would have done most of his stuff kind of in Tunisia. And Alec Guinness just hated doing it. But I think Peter Cushing would probably... He still put in a performance. Yeah. And he turned up for the sequels, didn't mind taking the money off of the back-end deal on all of the merchandise. But... yeah, but Peter Cushing... I mean, Alec Guinness basically said, yeah, I'll be in your movie, but you're going to pay me £500 million to do it. And they did. It was crazy. But you look at, when you talk about not turning up for work, it's kind of like, so Tommy Boy is this film about this guy that's got to prove himself to a company and make it successful, right? And it's, if you want to look at kind of like the parallel universe of what that film could have been, it's the film Chairman of the Board by starring Carrot Top, right? which is the worst film. It's the worst film. I think it's the worst film I've ever seen. Everything about it is just completely incompetent, right? To the point that I watched that, and then I watched all 7 Police Academy films. And even at their worst, I was thinking, they're not Chairman of the Board. Do you know what I mean? Even in Police Academy 7, there is a setup and a payoff to every single joke, whether it's funny or not. They're setting stuff up and they're paying off. Chairman of the Board is just stuff that's put in there and there's no rhyme or reason. And then it'll get to the end of a scene and then you'll have to sort of like go, I think I know, I think I kind of know what they were aiming for, right? And it's almost like a, it's almost like it's trying to be a carbon copy of Tommy Boy, where it's did we talk about this in any detail?
Not really. No, I spoke to you a little bit about Chairman on the Board on the phone.
On the phone, but not on phone.
No, I don't think so.
Because basically the thing is, it's a Carrot Top was a prop comedian in the 90s. He went on to have sort of like a residency in Las Vegas where he did loads of props. And he used to be like this skinny kind of awkward, gangly, redhead guy. He had like huge sort of like red hair. And then he went and did like either loads of steroids or he's had some sort of kind of like implants put in. And he just looks like he's got these. He's just like a muscle man with like a neck that's bigger than you know his head. And he just looks crazy now. There's a famous Batman comic cover. I can't remember which one it is, but it's got the Joker on the front, and he basically the Joker's got sort of like green curly hair, and it looks exactly like Carrot Top. Anyway, so the film is about Carrot Top, who is an inventor, right? He invents loads of stuff, but everyone thinks that he's crazy, and he's also a surfer, right? And so he surfs and he invents stuff, and then he gets made the head of a company, right? And then he's got to sort of like guide the company into sort of like success. But instead of Bo Derek being in it, you've got Raquel Welch. And instead of Brian Dennehy, you've got M. Emmett Walsh. And it's kind of like they're done like for likes, right? But the difference is that Raquel Welch, you can see the cast around him. Because it's Carrot Top's first film. And he sort of like has a lack of confidence, where he's just like going, how about this? Did you find this funny? And none of it works. And then he's completely let down by the director. There's one scene that starts off on a big close up of Carrot Top's eye, and then the camera zooms out, and you realise that Carrot Top is holding a giant donut in front of his face, so that you can see his eye through the donut. And then the camera sort of like just pans back, and he's still just sort of like awkwardly just holding his donut in front of this face, because it only is meant to work as a visual sort of, it's not even a visual joke, it's just this weird visual sort of like reference that they're doing. But then it goes on for the entire scene because they haven't got any other setups in the thing. So he's just holding this donut in front of his face. They never mention the donut. They don't talk about the donut. They've obviously found this giant donut. And the guy's gone, I've got an idea for a shot. Why don't we do this thing where you zoom out the donut? And then they just filmed the whole scene with them holding this donut. It's just, it's fucking insane. And the other thing is that there's no reason for him to be an inventor in the film, right? So it's called Chairman of the Board. So it should really just be about the fact that he's a surfer and he's like a layabout whose dad has made him the head of a company, right? Yeah. But because Carrot Top is a props comedian, they've gone, how do we get some props in there? So in the first 10 minutes, they basically rip off Pee-wee's Big Adventure, where he gets out of bed and everything is kind of like mechanical and his whole house is all set up. But they never really reference it ever again. Every so often, he'll sort of like say, oh, I've got an idea for an invention. And then he'll do like a couple of props. And then it will just go back to him being kind of like, so either he is a slacker that doesn't know what he's doing with his life and is a complete loser who's got promoted, or he's a mad, crazy inventor who's working tirelessly around the clock to create all these inventions that other people just don't understand, right? Yeah. But he can't be both, yeah. Right? It's too complicated for a film that is incapable as that film is, right?
And it's also one of those films that writes itself, right? If someone said, here's the premise, you'd go, okay, I know how that would go.
I think that they had a title first and they went Chairman of the Board, and then they went, right, it's about a surfer. So they wrote a script, and then what they did was they got Carrot Top involved. And so they changed the script to make him an inventor with props. And then he got his mate to direct it, and his mate had never done a single thing before in his life. And it's just, it's incompetent. I mean, it's appalling. Although I think it was directed by a person called Alex Zam. Zam has directed such stuff as My Date with the President's Daughter, Tooth Fairy 2, The Pooch and the Pauper, Dr. Dolittle, Million Dollar Mutts, and R.L. Stine's The Haunting Hour. Oh, sorry. Oh, God. He directed that fucking Woody Woodpecker reboot that came out a couple of years ago that people just hated. People hated it. It's fucking absolutely fucking insane. Oh, it wasn't even his first film. It was like fucking hell. It was like his 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It was like the sixth thing he directed. It's so bad. Chairman of the Board is just so unbelievably bad. I wouldn't even recommend to watch it as kind of like, oh, it's so bad, it's good. It's so bad that it's just jaw-dropping. Like, I watched it with a friend, and after every scene I paused, I mean, it must have been a nightmare for my friend, but after every scene I paused it, and then I got up and I just ranted in front of the TV about, like, this is what they were aiming at, and this is how they would have achieved it. But it's almost sort of like 5 minutes pass, and then you realise that they were making a joke 5 minutes ago. You go, it wasn't structured anything like what you would imagine a joke to be structured. It was just absolutely, it's just fucking insane. But I would say that so Chairman of the Board, it's kind of like a carbon copy. Like, they've taken Tommy Boy as a blueprint on how to make this sort of film, and then they've just replicated it. But everything about it isn't just not as good. Everything about it is pathetic. It's the most incompetent, pathetic piece of shit. And I own it on DVD. And I'm having a bit of a clear out. And I couldn't even bring myself to clear it out. It was fucking terrible. But it's like a cross between Tommy Boy and Hudsucker Proxy, where they've got like an idiot with these crazy inventions to sort of take over. But it's neither. Like, obviously it's not the Hudsucker Proxy. It's just absolutely fucking insane. But my point was that Brian Dennehy died, and then I watched an interview with him, and he was like saying basically that, he likes working, and he's always working. And he says, yeah, I like working, and he finds it fun and he enjoys it. And if there's ever any sort of like job on offer, he'll take it and he'll do it. And they said, well, don't you ever feel like just sitting down sometimes? And he goes, every time often I sit down, but when I'm sat down, you don't want to sit down too long, because the longer you sit down, the harder it is to get back up. And I don't just think he was talking literally. You know, I think it's, you know, when you think about stand-up, if you have like 2 weeks off, even a week off sometimes, when you get back, you're rusty. And then it can get to the point where, oh, it's been like 6 months. I took a year and a bit off stand-up, and it was really, really hard to get back into it, just like on a confidence level. And there is a part of you that says, well, I might not even go back to it. You know, it's easier to walk away at this point than to start the engine up. Mm.
That's Eddie Murphy says, doesn't he, about returning to stand-up, where he really likes the idea of it. And I think for years everyone was saying, oh, you can't do it anymore because you've made all these family films. But that's not the reason. It's just that he's like, he doesn't want to get up there with nothing. Because it's, of course, it's like he's got so much to lose in his head that it's something he knew he was very good at. But going back to it is this huge thing now that he just feels like it'd be a big thing to overcome for him to just get back on stage.
Sure, but because if he gets back up on stage and he does some jokes that don't really work, it's not the culmination of like an afternoon of just jotting some ideas down and getting up. It's a 40-year career that people are judging you on. They're not judging you on, you know, what you managed to pull out of your arse that day. They're judging you based on everything that precedes you.
Yeah.
But with Eddie Murphy, you would just think people would be kinder and just think, this is the guy that made Haunted Mansion, rather than this is the guy that made 48 Hours. Do you know what I mean? So it's patchy, isn't it? But I don't know, yeah. So talking about kind of like being in lockdown and everything like that, it just, It is nice to sort of like just sit down and do nothing sometimes, but I think it's dangerous.
I think so. Yes. I think I'm already suffering from that. Like the amount I can seemingly get done in a day is tiny. And it's because like you kind of, to get through those early days where they seem so long, you were trying to put structure on things and trying to go, you were essentially trying to kill time. And then you realize that, you know, you're not actually working as hard as you were, or you're not actually doing as much.
In real life, you sort of bookend your day with being at home, you know, where you're at home in the morning, home in the evening, and then in the day you leave your house and you do stuff. But here it's just kind of like it's just all at home, and you've got kind of like no markers, and it's just kind of like if you leave your house, you can leave your house for 8 hours and you can get a whole bunch of stuff done, but you're always coming home. But when you're at home, and also it's just not having kind of like that outside stimulus to sort of like, to inspire you to do stuff, you know.
And also when you're at home, you can just see things that need doing. So you go, oh, I better do that washing up, or I better do that laundry, or I better do. Whereas if you're out of the house, you don't see any of that.
We're very different, Nat. Your sound has completely gone.
Has it?
Oh, it's still right now. Maybe you just laughed too hard and then
I blew the fuse. Too funny, Nick.
Well, story of, I'm really struggling today. I'm just finding this impossible. I can't hear very well for a start, and I've turned my volume up. There you go. I can hear a bit better now. You can cut this bit out if you want.
We can wait. It'll be fine. This is good. It is, Nick. It's going to be different every week.
It can be real, yeah. But I've got a deadline at the moment where I've got to like record a song and a music video for tomorrow, and I've spent like three, four days on it, like fairly solidly, just trying to get stuff done. And you just think, well, I can write and record a song in a day. Can't. It takes me at least two and a half days to do anything like that. And it's just like, I don't know, I'm going to fucking make a music video by myself in my fucking flat. And but having the deadline is, I'm just sort of like, I'm literally trying to use every minute of the day to actually get stuff done. And I haven't sort of like been in, it's probably not that hectic, but I haven't been in sort of like a scenario like that since before lockdown. What I want to do is I want to harness that energy and sort of like go straight from this project into another project that I've been putting off. And then hopefully once that's done, it'll, you know, every time I achieve something, even if it's just sort of like finishing a treatment, and treatments are the worst thing that you've got to write, because it's not actually writing the idea. It's imagining what if this idea gets made. And then kind of like, so it's sort of like you have an idea for a TV series or a film or a pilot or something, and you don't go off and write the pilot. You write like, if I was allowed to make it, this is what it would be like, and then someone else can judge it. So, and give you like approval of whether you can go ahead and write it or not. And the thing is kind of like, so when you write a series outline, not only do you have to imagine an entire series that in the back of your head, you know, is probably never going to get made, but you have to imagine an entire second series and a third series to give people an idea of where it could go after that initial series. And it's just, it's like an incredibly, it's sort of like an exhausting process, because you're having a leap of faith and you're trying to kind of like imagine to yourself in the most positive way possible, well, what if this gets made? And then you write it and you send it off, and then you sort of like, you have to sort of like forget that you did it and put it behind you and move on to the next thing, because the odds are that it won't get made, or that it won't be right, and they won't have a slot for it, or it's not quite what they're looking for, or whatever, you know. And so you have to be completely 100% emotionally invested in everything that you do, but at the same time be able to let go of it at the drop of a hat and just move on to the next thing straight away. So it's sort of, why are we doing it? What a terrible job. It's sort of crazy. But hopefully using these deadlines that I've got as sort of like an impetus to move on to the next thing is kind of that's
it's also the best time to do work like that, right? It's because it's speculative and it's at a time when you can't actually do things physically, so you might as well do speculative work right now.
It's difficult to imagine what the world's going to be like after this, though. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, are we ever going to be able to just sort of like move on from this, or does everything that we do from now on, you know, like science fiction, let's say you're writing a science fiction story. What's science fiction? I mean, science fiction completely relies on knowing what the world is that we live in and then writing kind of like an imaginary alternative, or like something that's parallel to what we're living in right now. A parallel to what we're living in right now is just us going out and going to the shops and maybe eating some dinner. Do you know what I mean? That's science fiction at the moment.
Yeah.
We don't know what our current situation is, so how can we imagine what this crazy future is going to be? It'll just be lots of dystopian futures where we're all living in bubbles. But then, who wants to watch that at a time like this? I mean, it should.
That's
what
they
also
can make at the moment. They can only make dramas that have been recorded over Zoom or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. What's going to be the capability? I mean, sure, we're going to get a vaccination at some point, but it's just kind of like, it's just difficult to imagine in terms of, but not just science fiction, but in terms of kind of like, that's just an example, but in terms of just like writing the sitcom, do you have to reference this? Is there going to be, do you know what I mean? It's just kind of like, I've written, you know, and like, for instance, if you take something like Gavin and Stacey and you write, I don't really know much about Gavin and Stacey, but if you take something like Fawlty Towers, for instance, you know, like writing that in lockdown, you'd have to imagine a world where people are going on holiday, even if people are owning hotels are open. Do you know what I mean? It's just kind of like, So it's just kind of like this thing where you kind of like, you have to have faith in the fact that everything's going to go back to normal or as normal as possible so you can move on. But let's just say you write a thing about a hotel and then things don't go back to normal, or things don't quite go back to normal. Then you have to do a rewrite to just incorporate all this other stuff. Or you're writing stuff for a parallel universe that doesn't, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I just think that writing anything at the moment is just kind of like, it takes, you can go, I've got like a million ideas that I think, well, not a million, I would say I've got about 35 ideas that could be made into something. I did before lockdown. And now every time you sit down, you go, well, you have to do so many sort of like mental gymnastics in terms of kind of like, well, okay, what is the base level reality that my story is starting from? That it's kind of like you're exhausted before you start. I'm not like sort of being melodramatic about it. I'm just like saying that writing is difficult enough to sit down in front of an empty page and sort of like write stuff, let alone trying to imagine what normal life would be like. At the very least, you've always got normal life to start starting level, and that's not what we've got at the moment. So I think that's why, and I'm talking to a lot of like comedians and creative people at the moment, and I think that's why we're struggling a little bit, because it's just
I sort of saw it initially as a good opportunity to try and write something, like write a new show. But it's almost that it's hard to imagine what people will want a year from now, what people want you to talk about. It feels almost like, do people want escapism? Do they want this referenced? Do they not want it referenced?
Well, it's hard enough to imagine
what will the world be like?
Yeah, it's hard enough to imagine what people want at the best of times. Hmm. Do you know what I mean? And so you can only really write what you want. But what I want is, I want to be able to get out of my house a bit more. Not too much. It's not a complete nightmare, but you know, it's really weird. It's also kind of like, in terms of me and you talking, it's good to talk, but like, this show is kind of not just us talking, you know, it's us kind of like going off experiencing things and coming back and enthusiastically talking about it. But when you cut out everything other than Netflix and Netflix is sort of like covered to death by the general public at the moment anyway, and it's just kind of like, well, what can we really add to that conversation? It's kind of crazy. Although, all right, okay, so I watched Enter the Dragon this week.
Oh yeah,
that's an amazing film.
It is good. Yeah.
Talk about that. We talk about that. Enter the Dragon is really great. Well, it's got what's Jim called? Jim.
John Saxon, is it?
No, it's John Saxon and
Bruce Lee, isn't it?
And it's got Jim.
By the way, Nick has got IMDb open. He's looking at his.
Jim Kelly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you've got Jim... I mean... oh, yeah, that's right. Safari web content quit unexpectedly. Great. Ignore. So Enter the Dragon. So you've got... It's a martial arts movie and it stars Bruce Lee. It's like his, Bruce Lee's... Like, is it his first sort of like big American film? Was it his last big American film?
It's basically they're both, isn't it? I think all the others are sort of made in Hong Kong. And that's the first one that's basically made in America for like a Hollywood studio.
It's really weird because I haven't seen a lot of Bruce Lee films. I'm not a Bruce Lee expert by any stretch of the imagination. But what's interesting about Enter the Dragon is kind of like he's such like a pop culture icon. And you see pictures of him and he's always sort of like posing in a kung fu pose, waiting to hit someone, and you go, yeah, sure, it's Bruce Lee. But what you don't see is how charismatic he is and how much of like an actual movie star he was. You know, he's kind of like, he's got everything that you need to be a movie star. And he was, you know, this incredible martial artist. And then on top of that, to sell it to the American audience in a kind of like spaghetti Western kind of way, they put John Saxon in it. And John Saxon is just the coolest guy on the fucking planet. And then you've got Jim Kelly, who is also this absolutely fucking incredibly cool dude. So you've got these three cool dudes that go to Heroin Island to bust up like this drug cartel, who are also getting, well, basically they're getting, they're stealing women, getting them addicted to heroin and then selling them off on the, they're sex trafficking them. And it's just sort of like, this this amazing kung fu James Bond kind of movie. It's so good. Enter the Dragon is just so good. One of the greatest martial arts films of all time, I would say. Oh yeah, and Wikipedia agrees.
I think it is. I think that's exactly what it is. It's sort of like sort of CIA. Yeah, it's a James Bond movie. I think I read somewhere that it's meant to be... Is it meant to be based on Dr. No or has a very similar plot to Dr. No or something?
Oh, really?
It's been so long since I've seen that.
That's interesting. Apparently, what's his name? Rami Malek.
Oh, yeah.
There's some speculation that he's going to be playing Dr. No in the new...
in this Bond film that never came out.
Yeah, because... Dr. No has his heart on the other side of his chest and Rami Malek has a bullet hole in the other side of his chest and he's bleeding over where his heart is, but he's still sort of all right.
Okay.
So the thought process is there is that they're rebooting Dr. No as well. I think, who gives a fuck? Fucking hell. For anyone that does love James Bond, I can only say grow up. fucking who gives a fuck anyway. So we've been talking for fucking
track,
ages,
right?
Now we haven't got time to play a track. That's what Natalie's saying, right? I mean, she's shaking her head.
Okay, shall we do some emails?
So let's do some emails. All right, are you gonna play the music?
Over the top.
Right, the music's going to go, okay, wicked. Hello, Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf. Since you guys talk about movies most of the time, not all I added the not all. I wanted to ask what you guys consider to be a great horror movie. Oh, for fuck's sake. Okay. It's bad enough when I bring it up, but when you sort of bait me into talking about it, it's going to be, oh, God. Oh. I wanted to ask what you guys consider to be a great horror movie. I'm a horror movie addict, so I wanted some opinions. Thanks for keeping me entertained on Friday mornings, and I hope you both and Natalie stay safe. Best regards from your American fan. Oh, it's John Garrido. Sorry I was such country then, John. A great horror movie.
Perhaps you can narrow it down to directors first that you might like, who might work in that genre, and we can try narrow it down from there.
I think I probably would have to say John Carpenter's The Thing is a
John
good...
Carpenter's The Thing would be a good guess. Yeah, that'd be a good one.
It's a good horror movie. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I think, is probably the greatest horror movie of all time, the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's not necessarily... It's not the slickest horror movie, and I think that out of all the horror movies I've seen, you know... I don't believe, I'm not religious, so I never really found The Exodus particularly scary. And I might find, maybe when I was growing up, the idea of like vampires and werewolves and all that. But I think that those Universal movies are beautiful movies.
Yeah.
And they're always sort of like about a misunderstood, they're like maybe not anti-heroes, but they're about they're like tragic figures, they're misunderstood. You know, Frankenstein's monster didn't ask to be regenerated, and now he's treated as a monster, and sort of like people, you know, he basically is like a Jesus figure where he comes back to life and people, you know, almost literally crucify him. And so it's kind of like, so they're sort of like allegories, or they're
fables.
Yeah, they're like fables, and I don't find them particularly scary, and I don't find the idea of kind of like Dracula particularly scary, but again, that's like a tragic love story. Whereas Texas Chainsaw Massacre is set in the real world, it's just brutal, and it's not like the slickest filmmaking, but it's almost documentary style, and it's just, you feel at the end of it like you've lived through it, like you've been dragged through the film, and you feel like at the end of it like you survived it. And I think that, yeah, as a piece of filmmaking, it's one of the... And I probably haven't seen it that many times. It's just the go-to film in my head from when I saw it when I was 18 that just, I think, in terms of horror films, that first one. And then, controversially, I think the second one is almost as good, but in a completely different way. It's not as good, but it is... But the second one is sort of like...
There he is. Hello, everybody.
Oh, my God.
Hello.
Oh, hello.
I got this down. Good morning. Oh. Good morning, Nick. Hi, Nat. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm good. We don't need anything but Zoom. We don't need to see people again.
No, this is absolutely fine. What have you got on your shelf behind you?
Oh, a bunch of junk. A bunch of Dodgers baseball player bobbleheads, and they'll never play again.
Sure. We should introduce you, as you're on now. We should say that you are our special guest this week. You're Bob Saget.
I really am Bob Saget. my wife has to call me Bob Saget, and I wear a paper crown like a dunce in an old medieval movie. I've got some cool stuff. I got a Rodney Dangerfield Award back there, and I got a couple other. I won a student Oscar when I was a kid. I'm already putting myself to bed. How are you guys doing?
We're good. We're sort of surviving. We're in what? We're over here in London. Where are you, in lockdown?
I and some people are being bold here in the U.S. and they want to stop the lockdown and let's go back to work. And I'm like, I ain't leaving the house.
Yeah,
we're in now. I think we're in about week 5.
We're further along, I think. I don't think we left the house for 6-7 weeks. I'm trying to remember. I was supposed to go to Canada and do a tour, and then the night before I canceled, and they were mad at me until the next day they realized that they were going to have to be shut down.
Of course, so, yeah.
I wanted to go to Calgary, but they closed it. So, and rightfully so. So I want to perform so bad, but I don't mean that sexually. I meant, you know, because there's nothing hotter than a pandemic you know, people are going, boy, you must be having a lot of sex because of the pandemic. And it's like, oh yeah, it's a total turn on. We wear masks. You know, I got Purell all over. We use it as lube.
Do you think that everyone is going to be fucking and that the population is going to rise after the pandemic?
They say
in
yeah.
Like 9 months they, time.
They say yes. That is and that's where I trust the scientists. And sure. They also, you know, here in the U.S., we're not. Some people aren't trusting the scientists because it's not real. You know, things don't happen.
But there's going to be, because there's going to be like two spikes, though, isn't there? There's going to be the spike from like the pandemic, and then things might sort of like die down a bit. But then when everyone's allowed back out again, I mean, yep. I live on my own. I'm stuck in my flat all by myself. As soon as I'm allowed
out. Sorry.
I'm kidding. I'm not sorry. I don't mind it so much. But
you know what? I talk to so many people that are fortunate, that have a life, that they are comfortable being, they're not agoraphobic, but they enjoy being alone. Nobody bothers them, especially if you do what you guys do. You know, it's like I'm talking to people because of the thing I'm doing now. I got my fellow people in my head, you know. My wife's asleep upstairs because I chloroformed her. And, you know, that still works, that stuff. People don't know that. But, I mean, I think Cosby could have saved a fortune on medicine if he just chloroformed. It's old school. It's Dr. Jekyll stuff.
We don't know at the minute. We don't know about the science. So chloroform might even be helping.
I think it's the answer. I think you inject yourself with chloroform.
Yeah.
See, we you don't have leaders that suggest, you know, snorting cleanser.
It's worth a go. We just don't know.
But I think you're right. I think there's going to be everybody. I mean, it still takes science to figure out people are holed up together. So they're going to hole up together. And wow, that's rude. But I sure have a way of setting back the time of misogyny. but I also think some people are going to get divorced or break up when this is over. Because they've had enough, or, you know, they got so mad that the person they were with went out in public without the mask and went to the market and didn't have gloves and was 2 feet away from somebody. And then they come home and then they fight for like a month. But then I think people might get married as a result too, because like I'm loving my wife more than ever.
Yeah.
But so is the mailman and the other drivers. But how are you? All of you good?
Yeah, I'm sort of healthy so far. No sign of anything. Have you been well where you are?
I thought I had it. I had gone to Vegas with my wife, and I came back, and it just, I thought it was the flu. I went right on a Z-Pack because I travel so much, and you're not supposed to do antibiotics all the time. But I'm a big fan. You know, and I'll do 3 a year. And I took the thing, and I was in bed. I didn't have a fever, but I couldn't get up. And then my lungs were sore for like 2 months, and I have asthma history. So I'm pretty sure I had it, but I'm trying to get the antibody test, which I think Auntie Donna makes, the Auntie Donna test, which is where you're against improv. I don't know, but I'm trying to get, you know who Auntie Donna is, right?
No.
Oh, Auntie Donna's a comedy troupe. They're from Australia, but I like them. They're funny. But the antibody test, do you guys have that yet?
No, we keep being promised it, but it seems to have not materialized.
The whole world's the same. Nobody's ready for anything. All we know is you get a snake bite, you pee on it. That's all we know. That's where we're at in science right now. They say that someone's going to come to my house, truth, if I'm lucky, in a hazmat suit. And this is for first responders and some well-known people. That's how LA works. So it's not fair, but I need to know if I have it because I want to see my daughters in New York. And but we don't know if you get the antibody test, if it doesn't do any good. You know, it might not. You might be able to get it again because we don't know anything about this thing.
Yeah, no one knows anything.
It's insane. I mean, here we are doing this crazy stuff that we thought we could do almost anything. We can clone we can clone people. We can, you know, change the sex of a baby. We can, or we can do that outside the womb too. We can do anything we want, but we can't cure this. I don't know. It's just so sad. Are you guys, is your death rate up?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, we sort of had another spike because it's now kind of a, you know, there's a UK-wide thing, and there's also, they've now started counting deaths that were in nursing homes and things, so they've gone up.
Yeah.
And so it's all kind of shocking, really, just these sort of numbers that are pretty, and that's it, you sort of become slightly desensitized to the numbers, when actually you think, it's huge, it's massive, you know, it's not terrifying.
It is, and I'm so tired of people saying, you know, well, more people die of the flu. It's like, yeah, but they know how to fight the flu, you know. So this could...
And also the flu isn't like a new thing. It's kind of like this is the beginning of something. More people die of the flu, but this has been around for like 5 months. So it's kind of like we don't know how many people this is going to kill eventually. It's incomparable.
And it's so... And influenza... is which I just learned this year meant flu. I never knew the AKA on it, you know. But that is something that, you know, you can get if you get, I've had pneumonia a couple times, because if you travel a lot and you don't sleep and you work your ass off and you're prone, you get it. And antibiotics, they'll jam you full of them and you can live. But this pneumonia can happen, but your lungs, it's pulmonary hypertension. Your lungs get hard and caramelized. And my mother used to make that for dinner, actually, lung. She would just caramelize lung. It was her specialty.
Tell us about this new podcast you're doing, Bob.
I'd rather just talk about the disease because no one's talking about it.
Yeah, in fact, forget it. Let's just talk about the disease. We're the experts.
Right. We're gonna be, Well, I mean, we know more than, I mean, we just had, you know, I don't like talking politics, but we just had one of our head guys go into a medical ward without a face mask to prove a point that it's okay. It's like, what? Just put on a mask. I don't want to look at your face. I don't care what it is. So the podcast.
The governor of Georgia, he was the one that was like saying, oh, the tattoo places go back to work and everything like that. And after he announced all that, he said, oh, apparently it's possible to carry the virus without showing symptoms. And he found that out after he sent everyone back out again.
There was another governor that didn't know about it till 3 days before the lockdown. Oh, and the mayor of Las Vegas. You don't have this kind of excitement. We had the mayor of Las Vegas in full-on denial. It was one of the best things I've ever seen on television, except it's the end of the world. But otherwise, it's not the end of the world. I mean, we're ready. What if there's germ warfare? What if Cloverfield? What if there's spiders on buildings? So anyway, my podcast, I'm pretty excited about. Before, first thing, thank you for having me on, because I loved talking to you a few years ago before I did the Leicester Square Theater, and it meant a lot to me. You guys were incredibly gracious, so thank you.
They'll be the football guys. We don't associate with them. We don't associate with those guys. But
no, I was on with you, right?
Oh, no, it wasn't us, but I think you would have been on FUBAR, one of the other shows, I think.
Oh, damn it all to hell. I wish it had been you. I hated those guys.
Yeah, exactly. Ian Boldsworth, it sounds like. Yeah, so he's a terrible guy.
Oh, my God. No, he actually is a nice guy. Damn it. I hope he's well. Well, who needs him? I got you guys.
Exactly.
How was the British audience this for you?
I actually loved it so much. And it was kind of for me, I'm like way delayed because all my friends have all played there. And it was interesting. A lot of my TV shows didn't run there where you live. You know, they had Jeremy Beadle hosting the video show where I was the host here and in the U.S. of A. And then the Full House was on Sky One when you were kids. And then now I guess it's out somewhere. But now Netflix is carrying all the crap I've been on. So it's like people know who I am now. But I've been doing it for 40 years.
Full House was big here, and I was in a sitcom called Uncle, and we referenced Full House in one of the episodes, so we start talking about it. So
well, there you go. The was Uncle? Were you a Family Guy? Were you the uncle?
I was the uncle, but yeah, I was not a Family Guy.
I was. And so now this is your podcast with FUBAR that you do.
Yeah.
And FUBAR is kind of the biggest podcast service, kind of.
That's right. Yeah, FUBAR is the biggest radio station and podcast in my flat at the moment. Yeah, it's pretty.
You have
huge.
A tricked out studio. Is the studio gorgeous? Is it that red and white one? Is that all pretty and everything and modern? Is it that one?
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, it's a gorgeous studio. It's a huge.
So you're telling me you work in a silo, basically?
Yeah.
We're in the shack in the back of a barn. All right, so I might as well talk about what I'm doing. I was about to do this tour for the past 3 years, same as you guys. The world was just driving me crazy. It was just I couldn't believe what was happening. That everybody was hating each other. Within my country, within your country, and racism and anger and political garbage and religious stuff. And I don't talk about religion or politics. I try not to in my stand-up. I mean, I go and act in something, and that's a different thing. If you play a racist, you do. What are you going to do? But if you play a priest, you do. So I've been on Broadway as a priest. The show when I was in was Hand to God, which came to the West End. But I was on Broadway with it, and they did an all British cast. I think they should have brought the white trash version from Broadway, which is what the play was about. I was a minister. Anyway, so I've been wanting to bring people together in my stand-up and have fun with it. Jimmy Carr's a friend of mine. We kind of work the same way sometimes with audiences, and we liked each other immediately from the Montreal Comedy Festival and became friends. And so I saw him when I was in London and a bunch of different people. But the thing is, I didn't know what to do. So I want to do this podcast. And that was like I started working on it in like October to get it ready. I worked with the company Studio 71. And then I do two episodes, which are on YouTube as well. That's how we do these things sometimes, you know. And so you got visuals for people that can't just know that audio is a beautiful medium. And then the shoe dropped and I did two episodes, then got the home unit, started recording at home. I always had my home unit. That's just a dick joke in case anybody didn't know.
We got it.
Oh, I know you got it. I just wanted to tell you. You guys got everything. Oh, sorry. What were you going to say, Nick? I'm sorry.
No. So you started recording it all at home. Does that mean you're not filming it anymore? You're just recording it at home.
Well, actually, I am starting to. Like this week, Seth Green and Nikki Glaser are going to be on, and I'm going to do the Zoom at the same time I'm doing the audio recording through the board, which I didn't know how.
Where are you right now?
In my home, in my office.
But where on the plane?
In LA, I'm sorry. Do you want the exact address?
Yes, yeah, please, go on.
Let me give you my find my iPhone.
No, it's fine.
Okay, but what happened is I started talking to friends. So the friends, but I started, you got to get, make a podcast popular. I think this week is my sixth episode. You know, it's like the first 2 weeks, I'm three a week. And then I think I'm going to 2 a week, but I still want to do 3 a week. But I put a number up on the thing. People from the UK can call. So whether it's on Apple, you know, the podcast, yada, yada, and all the other places, wherever you get your podcast, things I'm learning lingo that I had no desire to learn. But you got to be cunning and do it. It's got to be cunning lingo. You know, please.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I assumed it was almost a reaction to the lockdown. But this is all in the planning.
It was not in the planning, but then it became it. It's really weird. And so I started calling people back. They leave a message at this number, anybody all over the world, if they don't mind hitting the plus. And if they could figure out how to hit the plus. How about a Zoom meeting? How many people do you know? You get on a Zoom meeting and everybody spends an hour just trying to show one person how to turn on your camera. I can't find it. My menus are on the side, you know, and it's like, go to a nursing home. That's nice. So I got a dark sense of humor. Is that okay?
That's good. Yes. That's good. We're used to it. We're used to it.
All right. Yeah, I know you are. You originated it. I wouldn't have comedy if it wasn't for the Brits. I wish the hell I lived there right now. Anyway, so I started having people leave a message, and then I call them. I'll put on Instagram or Twitter, hey, tomorrow between 1 and 5, I'm going to be calling people. And I just do. And I carve up a couple of episodes, but I really love it. And I'll talk to somebody. I called one guy who's stoned out of his mind. For 35 minutes, he's telling me he's from Iraq and he was going to be deported, but his parents, and then he's laughing the whole time and he's giggling and he's like, oh, I can't believe you're calling me. I'm so excited. And then I call somebody else and she's a first responder nurse and she's dealing with people that, you know, she lost a patient. She's got an autistic kid. And I talked to her for like 20 minutes. It's whatever it is. It's 5 minutes or a half hour. I don't care. Whatever's right. And just like what you guys do. And then my heart's like breaking for her. And then I'll do something because I'm trying to make her feel good somehow. And she needed somebody to talk to. People, as you know, I'm sure you found that. People don't have anybody to talk to. And so it really, it was, I made her laugh. And I can't remember what it was over. It was a gallows humor. It was a dark joke about death. But it wasn't meant in it. It was in a Monty Python sense, you know, I'm not quite dead yet kind of thing. And then I find it so rewarding that even this morning, I'm waking up, and we all do press. We all go do something. If I'm coming to perform somewhere, I do advanced stuff. But I'm looking forward to this because this is an ongoing thing. I'm working 10 hours a day on this damn thing. And so I also have guests that are of note. John Stamos, he's kind of my brother because we did that show together. It was called, what's it called? Your Uncle, what's it called?
Full House.
No, your show. What was it called?
Uncle.
Oh, my show's called Uncle. That's a good name. I'm sure we're going to steal it soon. Or we don't steal it. We buy the rights. But well, anyway.
Uncle. I think it's been stolen a few times.
It has. There was the man from Uncle, but nobody cares. But then... I'm having different guests. I've got Tiffany Haddish on. I've got Macaulay Culkin on this week. Friday was Macaulay. And then John Mayer and Jim Gaffigan and Bill Burr. Bill Burr ripped me a new asshole. He just went off on me for half an hour. He told me my stand-up is nothing more then all the jokes they cut out of my sitcom Full House that I couldn't use, and I just say fuck around it. He said, that's my stand-up.
But Full House, I guess, is a very, like, that's a family sitcom, right? Do you ever have people that come and see you that are shocked by the content you
said? Well, 20 years ago, yeah, because the show went off the air. The original show went off the air what year was it? 95. And then, so it was an 8-year run. But now Fuller House... actually on Netflix comes back June 2nd around the world. So that's the last 9 episodes. And they're my favorite. The last one's my favorite because it's over. So this is like rewarding for me. And I do, you got a celebrity. I hate the word celebrity because it connotates no talent whatsoever. Are you an actor? Are you a writer? I'm a celebrity. Oh, you cut ribbons at the market? Or you made a porn tape and you have a reality show. Is that what you are? And you have $1 billion. But I don't know. I'm having people that I love, people that are funny, people that I can just talk to. Howie Mandel. Are you familiar with Howie?
Mm-hmm.
Howie's a guy that he's like a prophet. He's like the Moses of social distancing. He was all about the fist bump, never wanted to touch anybody. And that was his own OCD thing that was thought of as being crazy, and he went to a lot of therapy, wrote a book about it, had a lot of mental anguish, and it turns out we're living that way now. I'm sorry, I just talked for 8 minutes.
It's good. This is it. This is
That's
it.
Right. That's right. Don't do it again. So you directed Dirty Work.
Yeah. Did you see it?
I've seen it loads of times. Yeah.
Oh my God. Let's go to a pub when I get back. Do you drink or did you stop?
Of course I drink. Look at me.
Are you? That's the other thing. Are you drinking more because of this pandemic?
I didn't drink for the first month, and then and I thought, hey, well, I don't have a drinking problem, and so now I've hit it twice as hard.
I hit it really hard in the beginning, and then one night I had like a second martini, and I wasn't nice to my wife, and
right.
So I stopped for 8 days. It was kind of like Hanukkah, and then I know you got a huge Jewish following. I do too. They're outside my window right now waiting. Boy, I can really quiet a room. But I did have a little drink last night because I'm hunkering down and watching. I'm binging on Ozark right now. I watched the Tiger King, and that's like stuff I never would have watched in a million years. Are you finding that? Sure. That you're watching stuff you would never have watched if there hadn't been a pandemic?
No, I'm trying not to. I'm pretty good. I'm like, you know, I've already got so much stuff I always want to watch. It's almost an opportunity to watch, like, probably stuff of a bit more quality, you know. I'm trying to kind of stay away from that kind of stuff and treat it like, well, if I'm forced to do this, I might as well try and watch good stuff or read books or do something.
You're smart. You're a smart one. I was, we went right from a show called Love is Blind, which is another one of those reality crazy things. And then my wife liked it. So I just went, okay. And then I got addicted to it. Thank God it ended. And then I went right to The Crown. I'd never seen The Crown. So I just started watching that. And that calmed me down a little until they got in all kinds of trouble. I don't know how. And then they changed the cast after 2 years. It's like having a new wife all of a sudden. It's like kind of threw me. I don't want to spoiler alert anybody. Everybody knows it. How did The Crown go over in England? How did it do?
Oh, I think people love it, you know. I think because it's on Netflix, it's only certain people that see it. It's not on one of the big kind of channels over here. So I think it's still more of a cult thing. But I think people in general have really liked it. It hasn't been, it's not at all controversial, which I would have thought it might be, you know. People,
yeah.
But, you know, I think it, in general, it seems to be really well liked and appreciated, I think.
Well, we OD'd on Downton Abbey before the pandemic, and I almost wish we would have waited, because the weird part is what happened here was everybody got screwed because the bandwidth wasn't ready for the amount of people that are home. Did you guys have that problem where you were watching stop motion television?
No. Didn't do that. Well, it's a smaller country, though, so I guess we can kind of get by with it.
I didn't have Netflix for ages anyway. My TV wasn't working for the first half of pandemic.
Oh no! And, did you care?
That's great. Well, I've got like these crates of DVDs that I've never watched that are still all in the cellophane, and so I just started just going through those, and now Netflix works again, and I just watch shit, and none of it is stuff that I actually want to watch. It's just stuff that's just like I might as well just put the TV on while I'm having my dinner, and then I'll watch 20 minutes of something, and then I'll switch it off and I'll never go back to it. Whereas at least when I did Netflix, I would commit to actually sitting down and watching a film from beginning to end. And right. I preferred it, really. I much preferred it. Although, have you ever seen the Carrot Top movie, Chairman of the Board?
Yes. Yes, I have. I was asked to direct that movie. And I didn't do it. I had done Dirty Work, which you kindly mentioned.
That's incredible. Dirty Work is great. Love it. And you've got, it's such an amazing cast.
It is. I'd love to. I see Tommy Boy behind you. So,
Tommy Boy is one of my favorite films.
Well, it's one of the best. And, you know, the Dirty Work was Chris Farley's last movie, the last one he was able to act in. And it starred Norm Macdonald and Artie Lang. And then they were in the revenge business, and they were going to screw people over so they could buy their father, Jack Warden, a new heart. And the surgeon was Chevy Chase, and it had Chris McDonald and Jack Warden, and had cameos by Adam Sandler and Don Rickles. And it was just full of people. John Goodman was in it when you blinked. It was like, you know, people that were around in Toronto, I would just go, hey, you want to be in a movie? And they went, what movie? And they went, absolutely. And it's really strange because it didn't open well in 1998. But now, if you go to the iTunes menu or you hit up the Apple screen, it's like right under any comedy. And it's not because, you know, chosen just for you, Bob. You know, that's not what it is. It's we are right now, literally right now, in the process of talking about the possibility of a sequel. And we've been working on it. And the producer is David Permit, who did Hacksaw Ridge, as well as movies like Face Off. I mean, he's been doing, and he did the first three Richard Pryor concert films.
Right, right.
And I've known him forever through Rodney Dangerfield was a friend of mine, and David Permit, and he were very connected, and so was I. And so I've been talking to Norm MacDonald, who's one of my favorite, one of the funniest people I've ever known. Not a normal person. None of us are.
And no, I love Norm MacDonald. Norm MacDonald's Hitler's Dog Special is incredible. And his podcast and his YouTube channel is incredible. Yeah, I love Norm MacDonald. When he roasted you, when he did your roast, that was incredible. Yeah. I mean, I'm just saying incredible a lot. But I loved watching your roast. Was it Comedy Central roast?
It was, and it was one of the earlier ones where I got to say, I said, I'm only going to do it if my friends can roast me. Because normally they don't have friends, you know, all of a sudden, you know, it's a Justin Bieber roast and Snoop's on. And it's like, oh, are they friends? Well, they met each other.
Chevy Chase has got a book that he didn't write called I'm Chevy Chase and You're Not. And there's a whole chapter on his roast. And he came back to do a roast. And not only were none of his friends on, but he had people on that just either hadn't heard of him or didn't like him. And they absolutely just destroyed him. And he had like just a horrible time doing it.
Yeah, and I'm well aware. I've heard nightmares about it.
About that one specifically?
Yeah. Yeah. I had John Stamos was my roast master, and it had Jeff Garlin and John Lovitz and can't have everything. And, but a lot of really Gilbert, you know, a lot of really funny people, but Norm, I had talked to Norm right before, and Norm was like, Saget, I can't roast my friends. I don't want to do it. I'm just going to read jokes from a 40s joke book. And I said, Norm, you can't really do that. Do it. It's performance art. And he went, I said, you got to curse. If it doesn't go well, curse. He goes, I'm not going to curse. I don't want to do that. So he gets on stage, and it's a 20-minute monologue that he did, and he read from cards. And he would just read, you know, just one silly pun dad joke after another. And then at one point he said, you got a face like a flower, a cauliflower, and just dead. just crickets are asleep, right? And then he looks back at me and he goes, I'm saying you got a fucking dog face, okay? And then I look at him like, yes. And I'm like, because I directed Dirty Work, so we have an interesting relationship, you know, because I so appreciate how funny he is, and he knows that we're close because of that too, and he gets me too, even though he makes fun of me too, which is a sign of friendship, I hope. But then I went yeah, and then he started cursing more, I think the roast itself on the roast is like 8 minutes, but he did 20 minutes and it was quiet, and it was, and he read the sports section during the other people. Everybody else talked, and he read the sports section.
on the clip that I've seen, it just keeps cutting to the audience, and most people are confused. And then you have a few people that are sort of like laughing along, but it's kind of like you get the impression that they don't really understand what's going on either. And that's what's so good about it. It's just sort of like, it's so funny. It was kind of like, I'd seen Dirty Work, I guess, like in the late 90s, or early 2000s. It was during sort of like an Adam Sandler cycle that I was going through. And then, when I saw the Norm MacDonald roast on that was a clip that I would share around with people. You know, special people that would get that sort of thing, but it was so funny.
Well, because it's anti-comedy, but it's what comedy's about. It was almost...
It's also sort of like a throwback to the original roasts, isn't it? It's like, yeah. That was the sort of...
There was the original roasts, and they were done everywhere, where you'd have a dais and you'd make fun of everybody, especially somebody that's nice is always good to make fun of. And there's a comedian, Red Buttons. Are you familiar with him?
A little
bit. Not his stuff. I know the name, yeah.
He was an actor. He actually won the Academy Award years ago for a movie. I think it was called Sayonara. I'm not sure. But he was a very funny man and a nice man. And when he was in his 80s, he would do a roast. And I was on the dais, and it'd be a bunch of well-known comedian people, and then him. And he came out and just did like a minute and a half of like clean jokes about the person. And then he just, in the middle of nowhere, an 80-year-old man goes, and in case you missed it, fuck. And everybody laughed, and he proved his point, which is, that's what people find, you know, funny, is they get to hear something that we're now so overly saturated with, you know.
So you've been a stand-up since you were 17. What was the route from that to directing a movie like Dirty Work?
That's sweet of you to ask. Boy, you guys are nice, gosh darn it.
Well, I watched your Rodney Dangerfield when you were on Rodney Dangerfield's club last night.
You watched that Young Comedian special, the one with Sam Kennison?
No, it was just you. You came on, you did about 3.5 minutes.
Yeah, that was that you just watched that clip, but Sam Kennison mm-hmm. was on after me. And if and I introduced Rodney to Sam Kennison, and if Sam was not on that, I would have had 8 minutes. But Rodney mm-hmm. kept going. He was a friend of mine. He's like, oh, that's Sam. He's unbelievable. I said, Rodney, I had a pretty good set. Oh, Sam, man, that's Sam. I said, I knew it was going to happen. I was going to be on the cutting room floor. But it still was a great thing for me. But, I mean, I was making 8mm movies since I was 9, like really
okay.
bad ones. And then I went to film school in Philadelphia, Temple University. And it's a big city school, like 30,000 people. But they had a big film department. And then I did win the Student Academy Award for a documentary I made about my nephew who had his face reconstructed when he was 7. So we added a laugh track because it was so funny. But but he's okay now. He's a real estate broker, if you want to call that okay. But but it was I met Spielberg and I met all these film people, and I was going to go to grad school at USC. But then I went to the Comedy Store in LA, not unlike the Comedy Store in London, but even at that time I went, it was my first MC was David Letterman, and then Robin Williams was on, and Richard Pryor in the same night. Michael Keaton, Billy Crystal, all in the same night. And I went like, and they liked my stand-up because I was esoteric and weird. I was very influenced by Monty Python to say weird shit. And then I would curse once in a while, and then I didn't. And then it was just really, and then after the sitcom thing, after I was in Uncle for how many years did Uncle run?
For 3 seasons.
Were they long seasons? Or did you have a lot of
No, episodes? Really short. We only have 6 episodes over here.
What?
We have six episodes a season.
Grandmother. Hmm. Well, the Full House thing made people think that's who I am. It's a clean freak guy that hugs people. So, I mean, I do that, but no one's pressed charges.
Sure.
But whatever. But but I just my stand-up got a little bluer for a while. Did a bunch of specials and they all seemed to get bluer. I didn't mean it to happen. They just did. And it wasn't like I wasn't dropping F-bombs as verbs, really. It was more of an exclamatory, just because that's how I would talk in front of people, especially young audience.
I was going to say, I don't think your stand-up's like offensive in that way, because I think there's a real kind of sort of kindness with it, right? It's never cruel. It's very kind of warm still, even though it's kind of blue.
Yeah, that's what people don't understand. They just listen to the words. But if you look at me, I look like your dentist or your proctologist, you know? I'd like to think proctologist. I think a proctologist, it's also a dentist. So then you could go one direction to work on the other end, and then the same. I don't really know how the human body works, but
my first introduction to your stand-up was when I saw the Aristocrats. whenever that first came out, I saw that at the cinema, and that was just like, fucking hell.
That's what I said when I saw it.
I mean, your one is disgusting.
I didn't want to do it. I'd only heard the joke twice. And the two guys directing it were Paul Provenza, who I'd known since I was 19 in Philadelphia, and Penn Jillette of Penn and Teller. And they spent 4 years on it. And I talked for a half hour. And I didn't want to tell it. So this, you don't hear their voices getting cut out. They're going, come on, Bob, keep going. I know that's when I'm laughing. I can't do this, guys. This is the end of my career. I can't do this. And next thing you know, okay, so she's working the kid like a hand puppet. And then like, oh my God. What am I doing? And that went around the world. That was the year, that was 2007. I had that. I was on Entourage a lot. I had a play that I was doing off Broadway in New York that did really well, written by Paul Weitz, who wrote the Nick Hornby version of About a Boy. And
of course, yeah.
Really talented director, writer. And I had a whole bunch of stuff. And then I'm in the Rolling Stone, a page after Billy Joe Armstrong, as a maverick of 2007. And all I did was tell the most disgusting joke ever told. So I'm a maverick. I guess it's anybody that goes and reinvents themselves, but that's how people perceive it. I'm not reinventing myself. That thing's all there. If you told me tomorrow I'm working on a thing for, you know, in on primetime live network, I'm not cursing. I'm a professional, you know? But if you tell me, hey, no holds barred, literally, figuratively, I'll do it if it feels funny, if it feels right. Otherwise, and then sometimes I'll have an audience full of 20-year-olds because my audience goes from like 15 to death, you know, which unfortunately is not as funny now as it was because of what's going on. I play a lot of nursing homes. And I go without a mask because I think everyone should be at risk. Sarcasm doesn't work.
You don't find that your audience is a shock sometimes by the content, or are they?
Not anymore. In some places that I've never been, like when I came to Leicester Square Theater, some people knew me as one thing, but most people knew me in London from kind of, it was also the beginning of my honeymoon, by the way. That's the kind of person I am. I started my honeymoon by playing Leicester Square Theater. I said, honey, it's gonna be great from here.
Great, you can write that off of your tax as well.
Well, we said that, yeah. The thoughts of the honeymoon and the fee at Leicester Square Theatre just there's no balance. But
how do you find the British audience? Because a lot of people say, I think a lot of Americans they're more reserved.
You just find them. You know, they're at the theatre. Oh, you didn't mean how you find them. I have a compass.
Fucking hell.
Infrared. No. They would have done successfully worn you down. I've whittled you down because that's not funny. It's just annoying. But I've always wanted to be British. I like always. My comedy sensibilities were like one of my gifts when I got a show that was on CBS here before I was on Full House. I interviewed Benny Hill, and he didn't hit on me, which was good. But but it was amazing to talk to him because he made me laugh so much. And I was young. I was like 27 or something, which to some people listening right now, that's not young, right? That's midlife.
Oh, it's young.
I know. And man, and I screwed up the interview. I did it, but I crossed the axis, which when you interview somebody, the camera's got to be on both the same sides on the other person. But I did it wrong, so we had to flip my image in the studio. And then it got to the point where I realized I'd done it halfway, so I had him walking behind me during my questions. And he put on the hat, and he was doing the old man. He had a little Maalox dripping out of his mouth. I think it was Maalox, I hope. But But he was actually incredibly kind. But then I was a huge Monty Python fan, like beyond. I mean, they kind of changed my life during when I was in college and film school. And then I'm friends with Eric Idle, which is kind of like a dream. And so he's in France right now. So he doesn't even look. People that are very well known that are lucky and have a place, he and his wife Tanya are just enjoying south of France right now. And it wouldn't be any different. Except for the fact that he's kind soul and his heart hurts. And they lost, you guys lost Terry Jones. And that's like, you don't want to lose Terry Jones. You don't want to lose funny people. You want to lose non-funny people.
Yeah, that's the ideal.
Right. Let's just get rid of those non-funny people that just stare at you stone-faced. But I've always, I don't think there's anything I haven't enjoyed. I mean, Peter Sellers is like an idol. I mean, it's like, was he British? Or he was pure British,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Nick was just talking actually before you were on about how, what the response will be to this. You were saying you're just about to go out on tour. Are you worried about what people will be looking for after this when it's all over?
Well, what's weird is since I played there 3 years ago, I have a new hour and I wasn't planning it. But again, because of the way the world was, because of everything. I mean, look at what goes on in the UK and look what goes on here in America. And you're like, what's going on? Is this Game of Thrones? All these people are rising out of the ground and they're not helping the world. I mean, so not to be political, but, you know, people want things back the way they used to be. You know, 200 years ago, that'd be great. Or you could go to the cobblesmith. And cobblesmith? No. Is there a cobblesmith?
There's a cobbler and there's a blacksmith.
Oh, and then there's a hobbler, which is like Kathy Bates in Misery. Yeah, Kathy Bates in Misery. They smash your ankles. So that's where cankles came from. Very thick ankles came from Kathy Bates and a sledgehammer. Trust me, I made it up. I don't know what the point was. I think there's a point. Oh, but I was going to say, I think the fact that I'm doing this, the fact that I'm in play as far as it's not an exercise. I'm not doing it to figure out an end game to it. It's like, I have all this stuff and people will know me more, I think, but I had a new hour ready to go. In fact, there was a critic when I played London that wrote, everything was great except this one piece, and they were right. And it was a song, and I took it out. I never played it again after, and I've never done that before, where somebody said something, people are gonna be sensitive to this, and they were right. And I took it out, and then I zipped up. Sorry, it's early. And it's early, so I opened with my zipper. It's got to breathe. I mean, you guys, who does not have pants on right now?
Oh, mine are on. Call me a good time.
I've got pants on today.
Are you wearing sweats or jeans? What do you got?
I've got jeans.
I've got combat trousers.
That's cool. So you're ready. You're ready for you're ready for Shaun of the Dead.
It's not cool.
No. I see you got a window there. You don't want to be hearing someone yelling out brains.
No, sure.
Anyway, I think the result of a podcast, which I have the good fortune of gone to the world. That's like people don't – I take that seriously because, you know, I'm a bit of a broadcaster in addition to the other stuff. I do like five things, none of them well, you know. But I love the idea that I'll go out and if people are listening, it's a whole other audience. I mean, Joe Rogan's like the biggest podcast in the world. And if he didn't have that, people wouldn't know the same guy. And, you know, 4 hours a day is a lot of time. But don't you find it the same way? Are you stand-ups as well?
Yeah, me and Nick both do stand-up, yeah.
I knew that. I knew that.
I sort of do this and I forget that we do it because it's sort of like it's a live, it's when we're not doing it on Zoom, it's a live pod, it's a live radio show every Friday. So I sort of like, we talk and then I forget that it's happened. And then you meet someone at a gig and they'll give you a present, and it's based on an exact reference for, like, you'll get a pair of socks that have got chainsaws on them, and it'll be because they heard you say something on one of your radio shows that you've forgotten about, and then you go, oh, well. So it's kind of like, you never know who you're reaching with this sort of stuff, but I think that it's really important to some people, and it's important to me, and I loved it. I love doing this show, and I love having guests like you on, and specifically you. Specifically you. I mean, it's
more than anyone, right?
Yeah. Well, fucking hell. Yeah, you've got, not only have you got an incredible career, but you've kind of like, you've met so many people along your way, you know, and just, you know, I know that we've already mentioned Dirty Work, but I mean, like you said, it had the present generation of comedians, it had the generation before, it had Don Rickles, who's sort of like several generations before that,
right.
And it had sort of like the future of comedy, and it's sort of like, it's just this culmination of all of these different comedians that are in this one film, and you were the guy in charge and wrangling it all. It
took a year of my life, and I was getting divorced. So we were in Toronto shooting it, and I got the divorce papers served to me from my ex-wife. This is in 1997. And I put them in the safe at the Four Seasons Hotel, and then I realized I really should have read them. But I was directing a movie, but I really should have read those divorce papers.
Oh, fuck.
That's life in the big city, you know. But now we get along great now. We text, we sext, everything's good. But thanks. Yeah. And the sequel, if we do a sequel, if we're able to, MGM's given us permission. We just aren't there yet. But if we do a sequel, it's going to have, you know, Norm Macdonald is regarded so highly comedically. Mm-hmm. And then about three people like me. So that's what Don Rickles would say. I was at a thing for Norman Lear, who is a great television producer. He did shows that were taken from your shows. They bought the rights for All in the Family. Sanford and Son was Tiptoe and Son, and All in the Family was another show. I don't remember the name of it in London. But it was about
Love Thy Neighbor. No?
No, I think it's
in Sickness and in Health.
Yes, that's correct. And but Norman really made it his. It was about his own wife that passed away, and Edith, the wife. But he made huge worldwide television. And he's 97, and he's a friend of mine, and he's vital, and he's doing One Day at a Time on Pop Network now because Netflix rejected it. He didn't care. 97, had to sign a 3-year contract until he's 100. But he knew everybody. So he did a documentary, and Mel Brooks came up to me. And this, to me, is the gift when these guys that I revered my whole life go, that's how I became friends with Eric Idle. He went, you're really funny. I really like you. And I was like, I looked around, you know, was Seth Green, Seth Rogen behind me, anybody named Seth, Seth Meyers. But Mel Brooks came up to me at this party and yelled at the top of his lungs, I'm the only one here that likes you. And I went, oh, that's why you're Mel Brooks. That's why, you know.
I think that's genuinely one of the most amazing things about stand-up is that when you do a gig with people from TV or movies or anyone at any level, it feels like when you're kind of backstage, it is just everyone's the same. No one's, it doesn't feel like there's any kind of hierarchy or anything. It just feels like it's like you're all in the same gang, right? You turn up and you might be on with someone you know that you might have seen on TV your whole life, but suddenly you're all in the same boat, and it's like this sort of, everyone's even. Yeah. Suddenly everyone's like,
You've done a lot of nice gigs, though, haven't you, Nat?
Yeah.
I've worked with some real cunts.
Oh, man. It's the hot dogs. It's the ones that are new, that got some fame, that sold 10,000 seats, and they talk to you like you just started, and it's like, oh, do I have to compare gig for gig with you, or do you want to see my TV rating? I mean, you know, it's like, I don't... it doesn't matter because I don't like competition. Like there's all these competition shows that were part of our lives. And there was a thing called Star Search. And I was like, I don't know, 24 years old, and I could have gone on it. It's kind of like American Idol, kind of like The Voice or whatever. And
yeah,
I just,
Star Search.
I wouldn't go on it. I wouldn't go on Star Search. I just said no. They went, but you live in a single apartment, my manager said. You don't have any money. I said, I'm not going on that. This shouldn't be a competition.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how I've looked at it. But you're right. It is an even playing field. But the problem with that is if you're on a thing like they used to do Comic Relief here, and it was a big thing. It was for the homeless. And it was hosted by Robin Williams, Billy Crystal, and Whoopi Goldberg. And I
watched it last night.
You did?
I watched you on Comic Relief last night.
I'm gonna load up on you, Nick. I'm just gonna watch everything. Both of you guys. I'm gonna watch all your shit and then I'm gonna like just start emailing you all the stuff I love. I'm gonna three seasons of Uncle's coming into my brain.
That's right. I'll send you my phone number and then you can text me when you've done that. And
do it.
You've got plenty of time to catch up on everything.
We're gonna have a drink when I come back. Because I promise going into a program when this pandemic's over. but the thing is,
about Comic Relief.
Yeah, right. So it was everybody was on it, and at the time, Chris Rock wasn't the Chris Rock people know. He was doing stand up. He was in that transition period between he had been on Saturday Night Live, and his voice was more mild, and then he learned what a great stand up comes to learn, which is just open up the choke and just everything is with conviction and you work the stage, but you also have huge content. He always had content, but he didn't deliver it with the same bravado that made him Chris Rock. And I was emceeing at the Comedy Store for 8 years. So I watched Eddie Murphy work out Raw and I watched him do a
fucking hell.
I was the host. I was the host at the Comedy Store. 400 people. He comes in. I'll get back to Chris and Comic Relief, but Eddie, if you want me to,
but yeah.
Eddie came in on a Friday night. He was in a red leather suit, one of them that wound up in Raw, and then he came in and it was about 400 people in this room. The Comedy Store has a big room. It used to be Ciro's, which was a nightclub in the 50s and 60s. It was very popular. It's haunted by ghosts of gangsters for real. Everybody believes it. Sam Kennison said he saw a quarter floating in the air. I went, okay. Was there coke on it, Sam? Yeah, Eddie comes in, the walls rumble when he comes out. He does the hour, maybe 50, 55 minutes. And then at the end, he gets huge applause, but befitting him, but not as big as the applause was when he came out. 1 week later, just one Friday later, he applied his skills as an actor, I don't know where else he worked out. He might have done one other club within that week, because I knew, we all knew, because I was living that life every night Eddie's at the Improv, but I didn't hear anything. Shows up in a blue leather suit, with that kind of Nehru type collar kind of thing, and comes out to a standing ovation, did about an hour and 10. Literally, I've never heard the walls rumble like that. It was like the building was going to come down. It was one of the best things. He adjusted every single thing. That was my school. That was how I went, that's how one of the best stand-ups that ever lived did it. That's how you do it. So Chris figured that out. So one time at Comic Relief, see what I did? Finally, I do listen. Chris and I came out. We did press together as a team. It was really weird. We're like, they're interviewing everybody separately. But Chris and I, somehow they were like, let's do Bob and Chris together, which made us both feel like, so we're not individuals. We can't. But then I said, we're a team now. And then we were joking about being a team. But I did. That was competition. That was one. It wasn't competition. It's for the homeless. But, you get 20 comedians after another. The next day, you read the LA Times and it says who was good, who had a rough set, who was off that night. It was just like, what? We're doing this for the homeless. Can we keep the competition out of it? There was one thing I did I was proud of. I had a camera. I had a wire up my leg, and I had a little tiny pin camera out of my zipper. And I pulled my zipper down, and it was a point of view of my penis camera, and I called it the penis cam. But I did a 7-minute set, and I didn't move. I couldn't work the room because I had a wire. I was hardwired, no pun. And I was softwired. I had a chode wire, and then I pulled down my zipper, and then you saw the audience in wide angle, and it was on the big screens because it was at a place that's no longer in existence, the Universal Amphitheater, which was a good room. And I walked up to people in the audience, and I was going, better or worse, better or worse. You know, I'm Jewish. I don't have a lens cap, all these stupid jokes. But it was through the penis cam, and they had it up on the screens of what I was seeing. You have a lot of jewelry. You know, it was like a very... It was missing everything except I didn't finish on anyone. But I would have been electrocuted. But that was like, and I remember getting off stage and Robin, who I'd been friends with since I met him when I was, before he got more Morecambe, I knew him. And he like looked at me and went, penis cam, huh? And it was like, because that was right in his wheelhouse. You know, that would have been all he needed was for someone to tell him that. And he would have done it the whole show. But it was just something I thought of. I didn't think, oh, no, this would be. And if Robin was alive today, I'd give him every damn bit I could give him. You know, he shouldn't be gone. That's a big, big loss. Him, Chris Farley. Chris Farley is a huge loss. People are needing Chris Farley, Robin. We need
can you tell
people.
Us a bit about? Can you tell us a bit about working with Chris Farley?
He was like a kid, and also had the darkness come out at night, like a lot of comedians, like you guys. You know, it's like it's what we do. I mean, he was, you know, okay. What do you need? Just like the character, just like because that was him. And then kind of like the thing where he would do that bit where he would go, why did I say that? You know, oh, you're Paul McCartney. You're with the Beatles, right? And he went, and Paul would go, yeah. And he'd go, oh, why did I say that? You know, you know, and then he'd pull on his hair. And I was just watching a clip of him last night with that van down by the river and, yeah. You know, that whole thing. And it was, everybody wanted to be Belushi at a certain point, but what you don't want to do is go that life route. So Chris got involved in that, and it goes back to a lot of stuff. It's pretty dark, some of the stuff. And I know his brothers really well. And one of his brothers, Kevin, was in Dirty Work. He was in the movie theater scene. So working with him, he wasn't feeling too good. And we were shooting a scene in a bar, and it was really a crappy place. It was bad. And he was resting in the attic upstairs in between scenes, and he was having trouble breathing. He was too big. He hadn't slept enough. And I wanted to hang with him so bad, but I was directing a movie. So, and then one night I was like, Chris, everybody go to bed. Okay. Everybody get a good night's sleep. And then all of a sudden at the end of the day at the set pulls up on motorcycles, Dan Aykroyd, John Goodman, a couple of motorcycle club guys, that's a nice way of putting it, and then Norm McDonald and Artie Lang, who was also on kind of a watch, you know, please don't abuse any substances while we shoot, and Chris all go to the Brass Rail, which is the best known Toronto strip club, and I wanted to go so bad but hang out with them, but I didn't. And so that was the dark side, where he's wearing sunglasses at night and it's like quiet, nice, always nice, never mean to anybody. And then in the morning, like a 6-year-old, you know. But I had an idea that I wanted him to play it like a Sam Shepard role. I wanted him to, because he was all in that green outfit and he was married to a woman that, look, it was 1997 when it was written, and she was... She had bit off his nose. His character's name was Jimmy No Nose, and it was, we had a little stitching around it. And he was married to a woman that we called the Saigon Whore. Now you can't use that today. Although if we do a sequel, I can't say we won't. But you know, you can't mess with history. But He was so damn. It was magic. I mean, there's nothing he did. And if he made a mistake, which he didn't really, I mean, it's one of those people that you could film anything that you would leave on the floor, you could put in the movie. But if you made a little bit of a go ahead.
I think Dirty Work is his second best film performance.
Oh my God, you're killing me, man.
I think Tommy Boy is one of my all time favorite films.
Me too. And Black Sheep was pretty good. Black Sheep was good.
It's good, but she separates them for most of the film, and right. And they're really great together. And but in Dirty Work, he is so funny, and it's a really dark film in places. And a lot of his jokes are dark. I mean, he's had his nose bitten off, but he is so funny in it, and he's funny in a way that a lot of his other films were very sort of like family centric, like Beverly Hills Ninja and stuff like that. And so he was sort of like felt like he was being reined in a bit, but with that one, it's just because he's not the lead as well. He sort of like gets free rein to do what he wants. He was incredible.
I had told him to play it like a Sam Shepard play, which was like True West or one of those shows that was just balls out and just, you know, kind of a, I don't want to say a white trash kind of person, but just play it. I mean, he's a misogynist. I mean, he's talking bad to his woman, but he would do things that nobody else would do. He would be like, when I'm talking to my friend, I'm talking to my friend. You know, it's like, what is it? He put his hand on the wrong side of his mouth because that would be the move. This is confidence. This is just odd behavior. And maybe he'd done it with his brothers, or I think he was just an original. And when he would mess up a line, he'd go, damn, why did I do that? I said, Chris, he was so hard on himself. And he was so lovable. So lovable. We did one thing that never made it to the movie. And it was near the end of the movie because we loved to be self-indulgent on that movie. And that was written by Norm, and Frank Sebastiano wrote the original script, and Fred Wolf, who directed a bunch of movies and wrote a bunch of comedy movies. And there's a scene in the movie that's 1 minute long where they're, Artie and Norm are holding these fish. And while they're holding fish, all these mobsters are getting killed in the other room. Yeah. All you do is hear the sound effects of like, oh my God, you're killing me. You're taking out my guts. You know, they're screaming. I'm a lot of those voices. I did a lot of looping, but it was all the off camera stuff, and all they're doing is frozen for, and it's 1 minute. I said, no, this has to be a minute long. And then we had another 1 minute thing. And I was like, cause 1 minute of screen time is a lifetime. Now it's, you know, the length of an Instagram, you know, or whatever. But there was one moment when Chris Farley came back to see Norm at the end of the movie, and his wife is there in the car waiting for him. And he comes over, and Norm goes, hey, what's going on, Jimmy? And he's like, well, Mitch, everything's okay now. And then he goes, so anyway, Mitch, and he just does that for 1 minute. And he's about to say something, and then he goes, anyway, things are going good. And at the end of it, he just breaks it. And it made no sense, but it was like we froze that moment for no reason except to fuck with people. And I love, and then we were cutting around, I cut back to Norm, and he's waiting for it. And everybody, the four other actors in the scene are all like this, cut around. But it's pretty much just him. Well, they made us, MGM made us cut it out. They said, what is this? It's the end of the movie. What are you doing? I said, I don't know. We're just fucking with the people. And it was written that way. It was written to be an obnoxious, long ass, just annoyance.
Bob, we've come to the end of the hour already. I can't believe it.
It is weird. I don't want it to be. Will you promise that I'll see you guys? Do you do live? Yeah. When you're back and running is when I would come back. Do you do in studio with people?
Yes, yeah, definitely come back.
Yeah.
So you had a life before this.
Yeah, there was. I remember in the distant past there was something else. I don't think it was always this way. I feel like it wasn't always this way, but maybe.
I can't believe that we just found out overnight what Zoom is, and that even Apple and Microsoft didn't have their own engine that does this.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, Zoom, that's a network. You know, it's like...
You're good to have shares in Zoom right now. That'd be a great thing to have, you know? Those guys, they're way ahead. And but thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you guys for having me.
What a pleasure it's been. What a terrific time. And
if I
your
talk
podcast
too much, I'm sorry.
Is Bob Sackett's here for you, and that's wherever you get your podcasts. If anyone listens to this, get on that. That's on... If you can hear this, you can hear that. That's the NFN Club. Back next Friday, 12 till 2.
Darling, you've got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go? If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you've got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go?